And with that warning, we are starting recording. Welcome, everybody. Thank you for taking time to join us today for the DWC Insurance Carrier Quarterly Meeting. We're happy to have you join us and give y'all a look at what's happening here at DWC. These meetings are intended to be informal and enable open communication between DWC and our system participants. So we are welcoming your feedback. We will do our best to answer any questions y'all may have. And let's take a look at our agenda. We're going to have a quick look at the topics that we'll be covering today. Everything will be also closed out with remarks from Commissioner Nelson. Before we begin, I do have some meeting reminders to give. Please stay muted during the presentation so that everyone can hear our speakers as clearly as possible. There will be opportunities, of course, to ask questions of these presenters at the end of each presentation. You may also post questions into the chat as well, and I or another DWC staff member will be able to answer those as best we can. So let's go ahead and get everything started. Kicking things off for us this afternoon is our compliance investigations update with Enforcement Director Nikki Carr.
Good afternoon. This is Nikki Carr. I am, as Kate just said, the Director of Enforcement. I'm standing in for our usual deputy commissioner. We have an open position there, so it might be some new faces over the next few quarters. We'd like to kick off with a compliance audit update, if we can. There we go. So in our audits and investigations department, this shows you the statistics on the number of complaints that we have received versus the number of complaints that were closed. In investigations, you can see here the breakdown. Of these complaints, we got about 1,300 complaints received, and we closed almost 1,500. So we're very efficient. Y'all have Diana Ramos to thank for that, our Director of Audits and Investigation. Approximately 899 of the complaints received were external, or 67%, as opposed to 433 internal referrals, which is about 33%. You can see that the breakdowns of the complaint topic in front of you, I won't go over each of the numbers, but one of the things to note here is that communication issues, the top issues that we received that were related to insurance carriers are failure to timely respond to an injured employee's request on their claim. That falls under Texas Labor Code 406-010. Failure to notify DWC and the injured employee of an action occurring on a claim within 10 days of taking the action, and failure of a carrier to contact the employer within 7 days of receiving notification of an injury. So if y'all can keep an eye on those issues, we certainly are not trying to be heavy-handed about it, but we love it if you can avoid us altogether by just keeping an eye on some of those top issues. Some of the confirmed top issues that we closed there in that 1496 complaints closed number are failure by an insurance carrier to pay or dispute a medical bill. This has been a hot issue of late. I will tell you that in enforcement, it is about 25% of my business, meaning of the confirmed violations. Enough of those medical bill issues are being referred to enforcement that it's taking up about 25% of our time. So please keep an eye on your medical bills. Make sure you understand the deadline. If you're going to dispute or further action is required, please send the notice so you can avoid an investigation and a referral to enforcement. One of the other top issues for closed cases is failure to continue to pay TIBS promptly as and when benefits accrue. We've seen a lot of TIBS issues lately. Again, I think that harkens back to some of these issues about, you know, getting the wage statement correct, doing the correct calculations, and we have resources for y'all. If you have any questions about that, please visit our website and call our hotline. One of the other issues that we've been looking at for our low risk, you're seeing there in the 279 DWC education letter. Those education letters are issued out of our investigations department because they are low risk, and it's just our attempt to get compliance by letting you know kind of what's going on. One of the hot issues there is going to be, you know, whether or not there's a bigger issue. If it's a single issue and it didn't involve a lot of economic harm and it's something that we feel that the education can fix it, then you might be receiving one of those education letters from us. If it's a bigger issue, and by bigger, I mean one of our priority complaints under Texas Labor Code 402.0235, it may be referred to my department in enforcement. And some things that are always going to be referred to enforcement is if you violate an order. It doesn't really matter what kind of order, if it's an attorney's fees order, if it's a consent order, if it's an MFDR order, if it's a CCHDNO decision and order, then that may go ahead and be referred to my department. So please keep an eye on those violations as well, so you can avoid meeting us. Not that we wouldn't be delighted to meet y'all socially. Next slide. All right. This is our complaints received by respondent type. So you can see that we've broken this out along the top row by injured employee, carrier, healthcare provider, employer, attorney, and other. Other is going to be any complaints from, you know, about injured employees, about URA, different system participants that you're not seeing in these top five categories. And we'll go over each of the numbers, but you can see that our two top respondents in terms of the statistics are, of course, the insurance carriers and the healthcare providers. On each of these main issues, attendance at BRCs and CCHs, communications, that's things like EDI, whether or not you're filing things correctly, whether or not you're communicating with the parties that you're required to by law, benefit delivery, both indemnity and medical, and quality of care. Next slide. Great. Let's talk a little bit about our audit process, our compliance audits for the year. You can see here that the death benefits audits, we initiated 24 and we have completed all 24 yes. of those. Sorry, was there a comment? Okay. On the initial TIBS audits, we have initiated 22. We're not quite through with those, but we expect to be completed with those very soon. We have completed 17. And on the medical bill processing, same thing. We've initiated 19 and we are almost completed, having completed 18. I did want to spend just a moment to talk about the death benefits and LIBS, lifetime income benefits underpayments. Some of the biggest causes of those underpayments are failure to obtain a wage statement. I do see a lot in enforcement, and I know Diana Ramos does in audits and investigations, that sometimes, you know, we short form that and we're doing an estimate, but we're never going back and getting the proof of a wage statement. And that does tend to result in inaccuracies. So please keep an eye on that issue. One of the other big reasons why we're seeing problems for the death and LIBS audits is improperly completed wage statements. We're paying benefits at the wrong rate at 70% instead of 75%. And we're failing to include like non-pecuniary wages in the average weekly wage. So overall, I would say that most of the issues sort of stem from those average weekly wage and wage statement issues. Next slide. Our fraud unit, I apologize too, I have a head cold, so I'm a little bit froggy today. For our fraud referrals and our prosecution team, you can see here that out of 900 fraud referrals received, 43 of those cases were opened, 46 were closed, and two of them were referred for prosecution. There is a very high standard for fraud referrals. It's going to be a different, what we call standard of proof. Just like you see on Law and Order, it's going to be beyond a reasonable doubt. And we have to have sufficient evidence to refer those fraud cases to a criminal justice proceeding. In our fraud referrals for prosecution, both of those were claimant fraud. One was working and drawing and one was falsifying documents. Next slide. Out of those, we got two convictions and one of them involved a claimant, which was an injured worker on the worker working and drawing issue. It was a Class A misdemeanor prosecuted in Travis County. There was a conviction and 38 days of confinement in the Travis County jail. The defendant absconded from a 2015 prosecution as well. And the second one involved an attorney. Roger Fairmont was granted immunity in light of his testimony on another matter. And so the matter was dismissed with court action, which counted as successful prosecution. Next slide. All right. This is enforcement, which is my department. And if you see here, we have closed out 687 cases. for this period, and we have 268 cases pending. We're doing pretty good. We're under 180 days on an average day to close, which means that we're efficiently handling the business of the agency. And hopefully y'all are hearing from us very quickly once you get a notification that your case has been referred to enforcement. Next slide. Here you can see our cases closed by subject type. Out of those cases, we had 546 closed involving insurance carriers, 107 involving healthcare providers, and 34 in our other category, which of course can include injured employees, attorneys, and other system participants. Next slide. Cases pending by subject type. As you can see, compared to that, to the previous slide, we're doing pretty good. We only have a little over 250 cases in our department. About 195 of those, I say about because we've actually closed quite a few since this slide data was submitted for slides, involved insurance carriers, 39 involved healthcare providers, and 39 involved other system participants. Here we've broken it out for you in terms of how we close those cases. We have a variety of tools in the enforcement area. We can close things with an agreed settlement order. That's called a consent order. We certainly close things occasionally with final orders through the State Office of Administrative Hearings. We close with warning letters, which is when we confirm a violation, but it is not worth prosecuting at either a settlement or at SOA. And we can close with a letter of education, which is when we can't quite identify a violation, but it's sort of poor practice. You might get a letter of education from us as well. So in 2023, you can see that for our healthcare providers, we issued 39 orders. We issued 65 warning letters and 3 in our other category. That's either a letter of education or a dismissal for insufficient evidence. For our insurance carriers, we closed 390 with a DWC order. And we closed 138 with a warning letter and 18 in that other category, either letters of education or through our no action process. Other is a very small number, 31 warning letters, 3 orders, and none, no action or letter of education. Next slide. All right. This is a hot issue. Nobody has paid their administrative penalties through the new CERCON payment system. I'm very curious as to why. I think this is a really convenient way for y'all to pay an administrative penalty if you do have a penalty imposed against your client. I would encourage all of you guys to look at the website for CERCON. It is through your CERCON account. You can certainly continue to pay us through the invoicing process and send us checks, but we're trying to sort of figure out why people don't want to pay with this electronic payment system. So I encourage all of y'all to take a look at it. We've given you the information here. There is a note here, please don't pay before receiving the final order and invoice from DWC. And I'll tell you why. So when y'all sign a consent order, an agreed order, and we have a provisional settlement where staff has given you a proposed order and you agree, we still give that to our commissioner and he gets to say yay or nay. And if he says nay, you're not done. Please don't send us a check. You definitely want to wait for that. And we will send you an invoice and we will prompt you to pay. Never fear, we will not forget about you. But please don't pay before receiving that final signed order. Next slide. All right, violations to watch. I talked about this a little bit, but I'm giving you the statutory language here so that y'all can help avoid further enforcement cases. So under the Labor Code 410.169 and our rule 142.16, you are required to comply with a decision and order within 20 days of the order becoming final. If the decision and order involves benefits, you have to comply no later than the 5th day after filing a written request for appeal. And I think it's that second part that frequently becomes problematic. I think in a lot of people's mind, once they pay, they're sort of absolved, or once they appeal, they're sort of absolved of complying with the order. That is not the case under our statutory construction, and we don't want to add insult to injury by tacking on a violation for failure to comply with this rule. Please pay very close attention to those decisions and orders. Remember what I said earlier about these being priority complaints that will not result in a warning letter. And I think, you know, again, that does not take away your right to appeal, and there is a process for recouping any payments that are made if, in fact, you win that appeal, but make sure that you're not adding a violation to your appeal issue. Next slide. And finally, we just wanted to give you a really good location for to find all of the final consent orders. We keep all of those non-private consent orders public on our website. You see these little red arrows, and that just means you need to scroll. If you go to our main website, you click on the gold workers' comp tab at the top right, and then just scroll all the way down to that gray area. You'll see a hyperlink for enforcement orders. We keep everything there. It typically takes a couple of weeks after the order is signed by the commissioner to get that redacted properly, and then to get that through our web team to get that up on the website. So don't hesitate to reach out to me or to my staff if you don't see one. We certainly will give you an update when it posts, but it does take a couple of weeks just administratively to get those up on the website. Just keep checking back. And like I said, we're happy to help. If you have any questions about final orders, you may contact me or any of my staff. Any questions?
Yes, this is Paul Williams. I have a question for you, Nikki.
Hi, Ms. Williams. I can barely hear you.
Okay. Is this better?
Yes.
Okay, great. Regarding the new CERCON payment system, we send the check over to the to our attorney that handles all of the Texas consent orders, et cetera. Any guidance you can give there? Like, should we still register for the CERCON payment, or can they register on our behalf? Any guidance there?
It's really hard for me to guide you on business practice because it doesn't have to do with the workers' comp law, but I will say that anybody that has a CERCON account can use that payment system. And, you know, I would sort of send you back to your counsel and just discuss that with them, that this is an option, it is convenient, and, you know, y'all can work out who would be the better party. I can't tell you what kind of escrow account or how the money changes hands between you and your attorneys. So I can't really give you advice on that, but more this presentation is to call your attention to the fact that that is available for anyone that has a CERCON account.
Okay. Thank you.
Of course. Anyone else? All right. Thank you for your time.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Mary Landrum. I'm Deputy Commissioner for Health and Safety. The following slides that we're going to talk to you, the presentation is going to split between myself talking to you about the Office of the Medical Advisor, or OMA, an update on healthcare provider outreach. Then I'm going to hand it over to Santiago Calderon, who's going to provide an update on the designated doctor program. And he'll turn it over to Greg Arndt to provide a medical fee dispute resolution. So before I get started, you know, I was just looking outside my window, and what a beautiful day it is outside. And I hope if you're in Austin, you have enjoyed this wonderful weather so far. But in reference to the Office of the Medical Advisor, last quarterly meeting, Chi-Chi, who is the Director for Healthcare Business Management, mentioned that the healthcare provider PBO assessment for this year had begun. And so there's been quite a bit of work that has taken place since the last meeting. So the process for the healthcare provider PBO assessment is really the Office of the Medical Advisor working with members from the Medical Quality Review Panel to review DWC 73 forms, or the return to work form, specifically forms where box C was marked, meaning that a doctor took the injured employee off of work. In this assessment, we have had a chance to review 584 73 forms. Each form is considered an assessment. Of the 584 73 forms reviewed, 207 of them were concluded, which means they were concluded as acceptable. Nothing was found wrong with those assessments. The remaining 377 forms, those are still going through the review process, and we anticipate that this review will be completed in the next 2 months. So hopefully by the next quarterly meeting, we will have a the final update as to how many were considered acceptable versus those that were not considered acceptable. So that's one activity. The next activity is in reference to the return to work plan-based audit. A little bit similar to the healthcare provider PBO assessment in that we're looking at 73s. We're looking at the documentation that's provided by doctors. But this really stemmed from the results of doctors that were assessed back in 2021. And this specific return to work audit included the review of 7 subjects. And we're pretty much at the tail end of this review in which we're closing 6 of those cases with a letter of education from OMA, the Office of the Medical Advisor, and then potentially one case that's gonna be sent to enforcement. The next activity is the spinal cord stimulator plan-based audit. And this was a recent plan that was approved both by Dr. Owen, our medical advisor, and also our commissioner. And we are in the process of beginning to notify the subjects that were selected in accordance with this specific plan. And looking just at the doctors who referred injured employees for a permanent spinal cord stimulator and to see the appropriateness of that stimulator. The final activity for OMA is the gabapentin / pregabalin with opioids. So this is a plan-based audit that is being developed. We are in the initial stages. We're looking at data, analyzing it so that we can finalize what the selection criteria will look like. This plan will be posted for stakeholder input. So you may want to be on the lookout for that. The plan is probably within the next couple of months to put it out so that we can get your input and see if there's any changes that are needed to the draft plan or we move forward as the plan is adopted. If you're new to the system and you want to see more information regarding these specific plans, I invite you to visit the Office of the Medical Advisor webpage, and you can find that by going to our homepage, DWC homepage, go to Workers' Comp Topics A through Z, click on O, and that takes you, and then you can select Office of the Medical Advisor, and there's tons of information out there. All previous approved audit documents can be found there, and those documents provide details of the how we carry out the audits, the specific selection criteria, and other information that may be of interest to you. Moving on to the healthcare provider outreach. So you may recall that earlier this year, we kicked off calendar year 23 with a bootcamp series for healthcare providers. And even though that's for the healthcare provider community, I know that oftentimes we see members of the carrier community, URA, and other agents that work with carriers that also attend our webinars. That bootcamp series was pretty successful. And so we are in the development stages of what we want to do, what kind of webinars, topics do we want to discuss in calendar year 2024. And so the goal is to have a plan of webinars, topics put out before the end of this year, so that people can start registering for those plans. So definitely be on the lookout for information that we will put out. And of course, our healthcare provider outreach webpage has lots of information on webinars that have been recorded that are available on demand, not just for healthcare providers, but anyone who's interested in seeing the information that we share with the healthcare provider community. And so more to come on the healthcare provider outreach plans for next year. And so that concludes my presentation for both the Office of the Medical Advisor and Healthcare Provider Outreach. So I'm going to turn it over to Santiago Calderon, who is the Director for Designated Doctor Operations. Santiago?
Thank you, Mary. Hey, everybody. Good afternoon. I'm Santiago Calderon, Director of Designated Doctor Operations, and I'll be talking with you a little bit about some Designated Doctor program updates. Next slide, please. Okay, so you may be aware that there were some recent amendments to chapters 127 and 180.23, and this affected the population of designated doctors and our MMI and IR doctors. We implemented rule changes earlier this year. What does that mean? As of April 30th of this year, DDs who pass the certification test on or after May 13th of 2013 no longer have to test. There's still the requirement to take the certification training before applying to be a DD or for renewing the DD certification. Some of the other changes include changes to the forms. So effective 6/5 of this year, the new 32 went into effect, as well as the new DWC 68 form, which is used for extended injury, disability, and other similar issues. Next slide, please. So we're happy to share that that the rule change has had an immediate impact. And some of these impacts you can see are as far as applications. From January 1st of this year through April 29th of this year, we had 55 applications. In the following 4 months, we've had 117 applications. We more than doubled that. And as far as our roster goes, we have 274 DDs on the DDL, of which 78 are either an MD or a DO. Next slide, please. Okay, the billing and reimbursement, this is the current rule that we're working on now. This relates to chapters 133 and 134. We recently sent a survey to system participants, and the comment period closed this past Friday on 9/15. Right now, we're currently going through the comments, and some of our goals for this is for a formal proposal to be published for comment in the coming weeks, with the ultimate goal to adopt the rule by the end of calendar year 23, with an effective date sometime in the first quarter of calendar year 24. Those are my quick updates. If there's any questions, please feel free to email me or DD Scheduler. I'll drop that in the chat. If there's no immediate questions, I can turn this over to Greg.
Thanks, Santiago. My name is Greg Arndt. I am the Director of Medical Fee Dispute Resolution. And we're going to go over some of the disputes that we received in 2023. Next slide. So for fiscal year 2023, which just closed at the beginning of the month, MFDR received 3,356 disputes. That was an increase from 2022 when we received 2,841. And 2022 was an increase from 2021 when we received 2,488 disputes. So we are receiving more disputes as the years go on. One of the bigger jumps was going to be in the division specific disputes. That's designated doctor exams, functional capacity evaluations, chronic pain management, work hardening, work conditioning. That was a little bit to be expected, as during the pandemic, designated doctor exams were limited. So now we're kind of going back to pre-pandemic levels on the division-specific exams, actually. So with the increase in the actual number of disputes, we are still actually getting most disputes out pretty quickly. The average number of days it takes to do a dispute from receipt from the healthcare provider to actual closure of the dispute is 67 days in actual fiscal year 2023. Next slide. Some issues that we've been having with carrier responses. The last time I presented at the carrier quarterly meeting, I talked about disputes that did not have a carrier response. At that point, it was 6 months ago, it was 16% during fiscal year 2023, didn't have a carrier response. We've gotten a little bit better towards the second half of the fiscal year 2023. Right now, it was 14% for fiscal year 2023 that did not have a carrier response. It is also going down in 2020 or 2021, it was 21%. 2022, it was 20% that did not have responses. So 14%, it's not a lot, but if it is 14% of 3,300 is about 450 actual disputes that did not have a carrier response for the year. An example of an issue that could cause is we did have a dispute. We sent it to the insurance carrier. The insurance carrier paid the disputed amount, sent the check to the healthcare provider. It did not carbon copy MFDR on that. MFDR ended up issuing a decision with order to pay on something that the carrier had already paid, but they did not let us know that that had happened. So please respond to all disputes. You can't rely on the healthcare provider to receive the payment and then withdraw the dispute. Some of the responses that we do get do not meet the requirements of Texas Administrative Code 133.307D2. That is the rule that states what is required for an insurance carrier response. Sometimes we just get an email saying we're going to reprocess this and that's it. So that's better than not responding at all, but it does not actually meet the requirements of the rule. So please do look at 133.307D2 if needed to see what is required for a response. Responses received after 14 days may or may not be considered in the final dispute decision. Generally, as a rule, if we do receive a response a little bit late, we do take that into account when processing the dispute. But the medical fee dispute officers do have the discretion to not actually take something that's received late into account when they're processing a dispute. And then lastly, responses that include prospective payment for disputed services may be supplemented with proof of payment. I think in previous years, 10 years ago, MFDR had asked insurance carriers to only make one response to a dispute. At that point, we were getting in, you know, three or four times as many disputes as, and it was a paper process, paper or fax process. At this point, we're receiving a fraction of the number of disputes. Carriers can respond via SFTP through email. So it's a lot easier for us to administratively handle multiple responses. And again, it helps us out a lot because an example on this is the insurance carrier decides they're going to pay for a disputed service, but they don't have the explanation of benefits ready yet or check. And then at a later date, if you want to supplement your response with that proof, then that helps us out a lot. It's easier to go to the healthcare provider and say, the carrier paid it, here's the EOB, here's the check number, than just saying the carrier said they were going to pay it. So anything you can do to help us facilitate withdraws in the system, it helps us out. That's all I really have. Any questions? Nope. If not, I'm going to go ahead and hand it over to Kate Sidora.
Thank you, Greg. Good afternoon again, everyone. So here at DWC, we are in the thick of implementation for the new laws that passed this session. So today I'll be giving you a brief overview of the laws that are all now in effect, where we are in the implementation process, and then end with a quick recap of recent statutory expirations, newly adopted DWC rules, and current projects. So let's go ahead and get started. Next slide, please. So Senate Bill 1122, as you are all well aware, designated doctors play a vital role in the Texas workers' compensation system, and DWC has been working very hard for several years to attract and retain doctors to this critical program through various methods, including those rule projects that Mary and Santiago mentioned earlier. So in October of last year, the comptroller issued a formal private letter ruling stating that charges for workers' compensation designated doctor exams are considered insurance services and are subject to sales and use tax. So in response to this guidance, DWC sought a legislative fix, which fortunately is what happened with the passage of SB 1122. So this is just everyone's friendly reminder that SB 1122 was effective June 18th, and it ensures that designated doctor exams and other similar exams conducted by healthcare providers in the system are not considered insurance services or subject to sales and use tax. There's no implementation necessary since sales tax was not required for these exams previously. And if any sales tax happens to be applied, there is no obligation for the carrier to pay that tax. Next slide. House Bill 2314. This allows for a beneficiary to file for a workers' compensation claim for death benefits, both with the insurance carrier as well as DWC, and requires the insurance carriers to maintain a record of any claim for death benefits that they receive. The process before this legislation was to file the claim with DWC only. So to implement House Bill 2314, DWC has proposed rules related to these processes for carriers to notify us when they get a claim for death benefits and those record keeping requirements. You can find those rules now on the TDI website, and they will publish in the register on September 29th. So you have until October 30th to submit any public comments to legal services, and there is a tentative hearing scheduled for October 24th. There will also be some minor changes to the DWC 42 claim for death benefits form, just to reflect the new methods that beneficiaries can file for this form, so be on the lookout for that. The law went into effect June 10th, and because it's already effective for now until rules are adopted, the insurance carriers could notify us through usual methods like email, mail, or SFTP boxes. Next slide. So moving on, we have House Bill 90, which concerns members of Texas Military Forces. So a reminder on this law, because there was a little confusion on this previously, is House Bill 90 does expand Texas Government Code Chapter 615 death benefits for eligible survivors of members of the Texas Military Forces. Those benefits are paid by the Employee Retirement System of Texas, and they are not workers' compensation benefits. However, House Bill 90 does do a couple things for Texas Military Forces members under the Workers' Compensation Act. If they are on state active duty and working under authorized written orders, it expands travel to or from their duty location or while they are participating in state training to be within that course and scope of employment. It also includes military forces members that may be eligible to receive workers' compensation benefits for post-traumatic stress disorder. And those would be a compensable injury based on one or more events occurring in the course and scope of their state active duty. This is similar to first responder provisions that are already in place. The bill also provides for expedited medical benefits for serious bodily injuries as defined by the Texas Penal Code, section 1.07. An injured member of the Texas Military Forces can request those expedited dispute resolution proceedings from us. This law applies to compensable injuries occurring on or after September 1, 2023. Next slide. To implement House Bill 90, DWC will be working on rules related to those military forces members' rights to those expedited medical benefits and dispute resolution proceedings. There is also a new resource topic page specific to military forces members on the TDI website. You can find that information on what applies under the new law, and it includes frequently asked questions on who they should call for information, how to file a claim, and how to contact DWC for help. Next slide. House Bill 2468, which makes significant changes to lifetime income benefits, is effective for LIBS claims that are on or after September 1, 2023. House Bill 2468 changes two things about LIBS requirements that would impact all qualifying injured employees. The first is that it replaces outdated terminology, incurable insanity and imbecility, with a new traumatic brain injury LIBS requirement standard, which is the major permanent neurocognitive disorder for which the employee requires occasional supervision in the performance of routine daily tasks of self-care and that renders the injured employee permanently unemployable. The second is that it expands coverage for third degree burns. Next slide. So there are changes that also only impact certain first responders and add that definition of serious bodily injury under the penal code, rendering the first responder permanently unemployable as a qualifying condition. So Penal Code Section 1.07, that definition means bodily injury that creates a substantial risk of death or causes death, serious permanent disfigurement or protracted loss or impairment of the function of any bodily member or organ. The other big change is this law allows for insurance carriers periodic review once every 5 years to determine if these injured first responders still meet all LIBS requirements. This review must include a designated doctor exam of the injured employee, and if the designated doctor determines that the injured first responder no longer meets those necessary requirements, their entitlement to LIBS may be suspended. In addition to this, injured first responders receiving LIBS must also annually certify that they have not been employed in the previous year. There is an important stipulation to note about this certification process. So if carriers provide sufficient evidence to DWC that the injured first responder certification is not accurate, the carrier may review the employee's entitlement to LIBS regardless of the date that it was last received. If this review is initiated, it would also require the injured first responder to be examined by the designated doctor to determine their continued eligibility for LIBS. Next slide. So DWC is currently identifying all the implementation needs for this new law, some of which are going to depend on final rule adoption. Upcoming rule projects for House Bill 2468 will include the annual employee certification process, as well as that five-year review and DD exam. These projects will likely entail new or updated forms and notices, among other implementation items. We've updated our website to reflect changes in the law, and we will continue to update and communicate all changes necessary to implement this legislation. If you have questions on how the new law may affect you or claimants, you can call Claims and Customer Service at that number provided on the slide for any questions. Next slide. Here is just a preview of that information that's updated on our website. You can find the updated LIBS information on the topic page, as well as in our first responder resources on the frequently asked questions page. Both web pages are linked in this presentation and again will be available on our website after the meeting. Now that we've gone over the latest new legislation, let's move on to a couple other need to know items. So next slide, please. First, we have the expiration of the statutory presumption under Texas Government Code Chapter 607 for COVID-19 claims, which was created under Senate Bill 22 from the 87th legislative session. This presumption is no longer in effect for claims with dates of injury on or after June 15th, 2023. So to be eligible under the presumption, an employee must have worked in the declared disaster area. Both the federal and state disaster declarations related to COVID-19 ended, and the state declaration expired June 15th, 2023. So additionally, the statutory expiration was September 1st, 2023, and the legislature did not extend that timeline. Both teledentistry and medical quality review panel rules are effective as of August 22nd. Teledentistry rules in Chapter 133 adopted amendments that add a definition for teledentistry services and a requirement that healthcare providers must bill for teledentistry services according to those applicable Medicaid payment policies. The adopted amendments don't create new reimbursement methods for teledentistry, but they do require healthcare providers to use that existing dental reimbursement methodology found in the rules section 134.303. So Chapter 180 rules concerning medical quality review panel mainly focus on changes that kind of conform with other related rules and current practices. They clarify the amount of notice to which a healthcare provider respondent is allowed before an informal settlement conference, and then clarifies that DWC can conduct those informal settlement conferences either remotely or in person. So moving on to current rule projects that are not tied to legislation, mostly have been covered earlier in these presentations, like the DD billing and reimbursement Chapter 133 rules. So Santiago covered more than enough of that rule earlier. So this is just a reminder to be on the lookout for that formal proposal coming soon, and also to thank you for the input provided so far on those informal drafts, as well as the recent surveys. I know we are also still considering a couple additional rule projects this year, but I do have to leave something fun for me to talk about at the next quarterly meeting. So I will just leave that for next time. I know Kara will be touching more on other rules and processes up next. So before we give it over to Kara, does anybody have any questions?
Hey, there's one in the chat.
Yeah, we will definitely be looking at some of the plain language notices as well. We don't have any specifics yet on any of the exact forms. We will be communicating that as soon as we can. All right, thank you.
Thanks, Kate. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Kara Mace, General Counsel here at DWC. Just want to point out a couple of new things for you guys that we have going on in legal services. Next slide, please. So first we have what I've been calling fast track rules. Fast tracks are just little non-substantive rules that we're amending just to clean up the administrative code. But these rules, even though we've got the rule open, we're only opening it for this really specific purpose and for this really limited scope. We're not getting in there to make any big or substantive changes. Next slide. So this is a couple of examples of recent fast tracks. We've amended these rules to do things like change the address, change all those commissions to division, simplify with plain language and agency style, and to correct some incorrect references. Next slide. So the next thing I want to show you is where you can find all these fast track postings and all those rules we've been working on that Santiago and Kate were talking about. We recently updated the rules webpage and made it more comprehensive and user-friendly. I don't know about you guys, but I really can't remember any of the rules by their numbers. So we have them listed by more of a what the common name is. So when you get on the site, there are stars that you'll see next to the common name of the rule. And those stars indicate that those rules are currently open for public comment. Next slide. So each rule now has a drop-down menu where you can find all the summaries, the important dates for both proposals and adoptions, and links where you can find all those documents in the register, information on a public hearing if we have one, posting memos, and comment period information. Next slide. So here's an example of what a rule looks like in the drop-down. So everything is all in one place. It's all linked up to find what you might need regarding the rule. The posting memo is there, a link to the PDF and the pretty version of the rule, then the link to the register where it's published, and all important dates associated with the rule are right there. So we really hope you guys enjoy using the new webpage. I want to thank my team for taking initiative on this project and for getting it updated and maintained all the time so well. And that's all I have for you guys from Legal Services today. So thank you, and I'm going to turn it over to Kim Donovan for her reg update.
Thank you, Kara. Good afternoon, everyone. As Kara mentioned, I'm Kim Donovan. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for Operations and External Relations. So for this quarter, Kate Sidora gave you all the legislative update. I'll be providing an update for the research and evaluation group. I had mentioned in the last quarterly meeting that we were about to publish the return to work report. It was published in July. Next slide. So as we all know, one goal of the Texas workers' compensation system is to return injured employees back to work quickly and safely. This report analyzes the return to work outcomes for the Texas workers' compensation system between 2007 and 2020, including an examination of injured Texas employees' initial and sustained return to work rates and wage recovery rates. Just to make sure we're on the same page, initial return to work is when the employee earns any amount of wage after the injury date, meaning they went back to work in some sort of capacity and the return to work may not be sustained. Sustained return to work is when the injured employee has been earning wages for at least three consecutive quarters after the injury date. It's important to note that several factors outside of the Texas workers' compensation system affect return to work rates for injured employees, including the state's economy, unemployment rates, industry changes, and changing employee demographics, among others. However, that said, return to work rates are an important gauge of the overall effectiveness of a state workers' compensation system. I also want to point out that the report reflects lower sustained and initial return to work rates in 2019, then generally recovering in 2020. And this variance may be due to work interruption beginning in early 2020 due to COVID-19. So now that I've got the disclaimers out of the way, overall the findings show steady improvements in return to work rates for Texas injured employees in the last decade. The key findings are 92% of employees back at work within 1 year of their injury. And while the initial return to work rate slightly declined in 2019 across all employer sizes, Again, 92% of injured employees returned to work within 1 year post-injury, and 96% returned within 3 years post-injury. I also want to point out that the initial return to work rates differ by industry sector. So employees in the mining, utilities, construction industry had the lowest initial return to work rate at 76% in 2020. Public administration injured employees have consistently had the highest return to work rates within 6 months of injury at 90% in 2020. 69% of employees back at work within 6 months stay at work. And it takes around 2 years for employees who return to work within 6 months to get back to the pre-injury wage. So those employees that don't return to work within 6 months take around 3 years to get back to pre-injury wage levels. Those employees also tend to have lower pre-injury wages than employees who do return to work within 6 months, which may indicate that there may be also other factors affecting an injured employee's ability to return to pre-injury wages, such as differences in occupation, availability of employer light duty options, need for employee retraining, et cetera. The last key finding I wanted to point out today is that it takes 43 days on average for employees to return to work. So there's a lot of other good information in this report. I encourage all of you to go look at this and the other great work that's done by the research and evaluation group. Next slide. So we have a lot of reports that are going to be coming out in the coming month or so. One is the pharmacy cost and utilization, which is an updated analysis of the impact of the pharmacy closed formulary on the utilization and cost patterns in pharmacy prescriptions for new and legacy claims and post-formulary trends in the utilization of physical medicine in the Texas workers' compensation system. We're also going to have the medical cost and utilization report, which is an update of medical costs and utilization in the Texas workers' compensation system, with additional attention on the cost and utilization of office visits and physical medicine services. And then the access to care, which is an analysis of injured employee access to medical care provided under the workers' compensation system, including an analysis of access to medical care through TDI, Certified Workers' Compensation Healthcare Networks. Next slide, please. So this is the proposed fiscal year 2024 research agenda. It is posted on our website. I'm not gonna go through all of these, but I did wanna have them on the screen for y'all to see as well. What I do wanna cover is that written comments are due by 5 p.m. Central Time on October 16th. I will, after my presentation, I will drop in the chat a link directly to the agenda, which includes the information on how to submit those written comments. Next slide. So hopefully y'all can see this. This screenshot I know is a little bit small, but this is where you can find everything reg related. Hopefully y'all already know this and y'all go and actively look at the reports and the different things that we have coming out, the resources for y'all, but just in case, I wanted to provide it here. The link is also in the PowerPoint, which will be made available as Kate mentioned earlier. But again, I will drop, to make it easy, I will drop it into the chat here. And then also for anybody who's just wanting to know, as with all pages on our websites, there's various different ways to access it. I think arguably the easiest way, other than the link that I will drop in the chat for you, is when you're on the workers' compensation main page. If you go down to the bottom, there is a piece, or I should say a section, that says more workers' compensation at TDI, and there is a link for the workers' compensation research and evaluation group. So unless there's any questions for me, I will turn it back over to Commissioner Nelson for closing remarks. Or actually, I apologize. It's going to be Martha.
Oh, that's all right, Kim.
I mean, leaving out the EDI update, saving the best for almost last, right?
Oh, yeah. Don't put so much pressure on me. good afternoon, everybody. Martha Levinum, the Director for Enterprise Automation Services. Go to the next slide, please. So I'm happy to announce that you're not going to hear me count down anymore to the claim EDI standard. We've left that 1995 standard behind, and we successfully implemented claim EDI 3.1 on July 26th. So it went very smoothly, actually. We were very happy with all the cooperation and participation by carriers and their agents, and of course our agent, all working together. And so over the last 3 years preparing for this, so this is as much a success for the carriers and the claim administrators as it is for the DWC. So once again, I thank you all for participating and for all your feedback. One of the things I wanted to mention today is that we are going to start monitoring for some of the newer EDI reports, and we're also trying to make an effort not to do so much claim creation on the DWC side. So that avoids, you know, duplication and maybe us creating a claim that you all were already going to file. So one of the advantages to 3.1 is that those claims will be created much quicker than under the old standard, but there are still some, especially PLNs, that we see sort of lingering around without a companion claim. So EDI staff, my staff are monitoring for PLN 1s, PLN 11s, and PLN 14s that don't have a claim creation or a first report of injury in our system. So we will be reaching out to claim administrators, and we might need your help. We may reach out to the carrier as well if we see that there's some kind of pattern for that. But just a heads up that we will be monitoring those particular types of PLNs for the companion EDI reports. One of the other things I'd like to remind everyone is that EDI change reports are what carriers and claim administrators should be using to update injured employee IDs, addresses, phone numbers, and dates of injury. And you can include first names and last names of injured workers as well. So we still are getting quite a bit of email volume asking for updates of employee IDs, first name, last name, all that stuff. So I want to remind you that now you can use those EDI change reports to update all of that sort of critical or match data on a claim. One last thing, scorecards and other claim EDI reports right now are delayed. I'm sure that a lot of you have already noticed the DWC 29 reports and that you request on a monthly basis are missing the claim EDI information for August. And we are working on, you know, using the new data and implementing it into our reporting so that they are going to be a little delayed. And as soon as we have that information, those detailed reports will be sent to you through the normal channels, through the SFTP boxes. Next slide. So next slide is a reminder, billing for costs associated with claim EDI 3.1. There were the first invoices that were sent before the implementation, and now there are going to be more invoices that are going to be sent for billing on the second half of the one-time costs and then the ongoing costs of collecting the EDI. And those bills will come from Verisk, who is our data collection agent. So if you need to go back and refresh your memory on the billing process, there are a couple of links in the ongoing billing section or the little square there that will take you to the FAQs, which go through the calculation and also the previous memos that the division has issued. We did issue a reminder on July 18th, so that's the last memo that maybe came through the SFTPs, just as a reminder to prepare you for that next billing cycle. Next slide. Okay, so if you have questions about the Claim EDI 3.1 implementation, there are three primary contacts for that. If you have questions about the standard, or if you receive rejections, or if you need to update your claim EDI registration, you're going to email txdwcedi@verisk.com. So one of the services that our data agent also provides is answering questions and also working with us to, you know, prioritize and filter through questions. And they also have the registration. Next thing, if you have questions about invoicing or billing, there's a second email address. That's the second one listed. And then EDI support will take care of you if you need to make changes to the EDI 03 compliance coordinators, claim and medical. You want to get a hold of them or send us an email there. And that is all I have. And I will turn it now over to Commissioner Nelson.
Thank you. All right. Well, I hope you all have enjoyed this meeting so far. We're working on revamping it, and I think it's going pretty well. I did want to touch on a few things, kind of echo some topics that some of our folks touched on. First, Martha Leveno and her team have done a great job with the EDI project. I mean, that was a four-year project for her and her team, as well as Tammy Campion, who's over that program area. And I think it went off pretty much without a hitch. You know, kudos to their team. They did a lot of work. They put a lot of effort into it, but I think it all paid off. I also did want to mention one thing that Nikki talked about during the enforcement update. She mentioned that we do have a lot of enforcement orders coming out right now related to late or inaccurate medical payments or addressing medical bills at all. We do have a lot of enforcement actions coming out on that. Currently, part of that is a symptom of we are receiving a lot more complaints on that. When we receive complaints, we investigate those complaints. And if it is a confirmed complaint, it gets sent to enforcement. So like she said, that seems to be a focus out there in the medical community. So it's probably something that you all want to take a look at and see if there's anything you can tighten up on your end. Santiago went over the designated doctor rules, so I won't go into too much about what they did, but you know, that's been another project that's been about 2 years in the making. And the designated doctor system, I think, is a great program for Texas. I think it's a cost saver for our system. I know a lot of other states look to us and would like to model a similar system in their states. But the fact is, between 2018 and 2022, we lost about 250 DDs from the system. You know, I think part of that was leveling out. I think having over 500 doctors may be a little too much. But the two things we heard the most from them was, number one was fees, and number two was the testing that they were required to do every 2 years. So these rule projects that we've been doing to increase their fees and to change some of the testing requirements has helped. I mean, I think we're already seeing the proofs in the pudding. You know, in January of 23, we had 239 DDs. We're up to 274 today. We have more MDs and DOs joining the system as well. And I think once we see these fee rules go into effect, I think we'll even see more of an increase there. The goal is to recruit and retain the best doctors that we can. And I think this is really going to help with that goal. One thing that I did want to touch on that wasn't talked about is we are going to take a look over the next year at moving from the AMA Guides to Impairment, the fourth edition, to the sixth edition. A lot of other states have already made this change, but we have been working with the fourth edition for quite some time now. I understand this is a big change. I think we all know if we did make that change, it would be significant. But the fact is that the fourth edition is outdated. It was published in 1993, I believe. A lot has changed in medicine since then. A lot has changed in the Texas workers' comp system since then. So I think it's time we take a look at it. You know, our hope had been, just to be candid, to do this through the legislative sunset review process. You know, fortunately, unfortunately, however you look at it, we got pushed back 4 years this past session, and I don't think we can really wait any longer to take a look at this. So this is going to be a very deliberative process that we undertake. Our research and evaluation group, along with our medical quality review panel doctors, are going to be very involved in this process. Our doctors are going to take a look at a range of conditions and injuries and ages and see how impairment ratings are affected by using the sixth edition. From there, we will see if it has a significant impact on impairment ratings one way or the other. If it does, we may make recommendations to the legislature next session to make some minor adjustments to the benefit structure. Now, that's getting way ahead of ourselves. We have no idea what this study is going to show, but I did want to get it on your radar now, since that's something we're beginning to undertake. There's going to be a lot of opportunities for input throughout this process, but our goal is to get a report done in advance of next session in case we do need to make any recommendations to the legislature for changes. Excuse me. The last thing I forgot to touch on here is Kim talked about our research and evaluation group reports and a few reports that are going to be coming out soon. Our pharmacy report should be coming out in the next week or two. And I think it's got some very good numbers in there. I don't think it's going to be anything that is a big surprise to anyone. But with the implementation of the pharmacy formulary, we saw cost reductions of 73% from $163 million in pharmacy fees to $44 million today. Cost per claims are down almost 40%. And this is all while we're seeing improved outcomes, improved return to work. So I think it's no surprise that a lot of other states have modeled their formularies off of Texas's, but I would take a look at that report when it comes out because it's got some pretty stunning numbers in there. The last thing, we are continuing to work on improving these quarterly meetings to make sure you all are getting what you want out of it. We've had some feedback that people maybe want to go back to a few in-person meetings a year. Maybe they don't want to see all this data presented in the meeting, but they still want access to that data. So we're going to be putting a survey in the chat here, but we're also going to be putting a survey out through email for you all to provide your feedback on topics you want to hear about, what we can do better, how we can make some changes. So you all are getting some value out of this. So if you would take your time to do that, just a few questions. It's not a lot, but we would really appreciate it to help give us an idea of what you're looking for. And with that, I'm happy to open up for any questions, if anyone has any. All right. Well, we appreciate everyone's time, and we'll see y'all next time.
Thank you.